Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And welcome aboard to The Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 51. This is Andrew Horowitz, and of course, I'm your host, your humble and loyal host for this wonderful podcast and this thing we call the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We have a wonderful show lined up today, a wonderful episode that's going to hopefully bring you some education, some information, and hopefully some insight into not only the market, something much more special right now, because I've been rambling about these markets and a few stocks here and there and some funds, but how about we give you some ideas on how to make money inside and out of the markets? Don't worry about the markets for a while. Maybe we can go outside of that. We could find some ways. It could be, I mean, things as simple as, well, I don't know, let's vending machines or maybe even we'll go to the Forex markets, even though it's outside the stock market, maybe the Forex markets. Maybe we'll look at some tax liens. Well, I have a great expert lined up. His name is Jordan Goodman. I've known him for many years. You got to hear the story about how I met him, actually. And he wrote a book called Fast Profits in Hard Times, 10 Secret Strategies that Can Make You very Wealthy. So I'm going to kind of grill him on, I read his book. It's a wonderful book. Wonderful book. Wow. I mean, just a great, it's kind of a different thing because it gives you a different level of understanding of many of the areas that are extremely profitable, but most people just don't use. And then we're going to talk with John Byrne, who is the executive editor for Business Week. He is the man who really is behind all of the wonderful podcasts on the Business Week network. Business Week has, I think it's over 1 million downloads per month right now, has 25 different podcasts, all related to business, not only business as per maybe just a business subject, but also the outskirts in terms of technology and podcasting and on the edge. And there's one that he does every week called Behind the Cover that goes along and talks to the writer of the cover stories at Business Week and really understands a little bit, you know, explains a little bit more about what they're talking about from the aspect of really behind the scenes. And then, of course, we have a wonderful edition of the Zach Zone with Zachary Scheidt, and that's going to talk about IPOs and a couple of other areas today that are going to be some great profit zones. I'm going to give you a quick apology. Last week, we were not able to get the Zach Zone up in time, and Zach had, of course, it was last week, right? He had some great solar stocks that he was talking about that I think would have been wonderful for you. But I apologize for that. We're trying to do our best to get this going. Other than that, I want to let you know that please visit the blog this week. If you picked up that idea I had of Capital One Financial, we'll see how it goes next week. But so far, you have some nice profits there. I'm talking about shorting Capital One for all those wonderful reasons, like credit card delinquencies. And finally, you know what I'm going to tell you next? Do me a favor. Pick up a copy of The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. That's what keeps this show going. That's kind of the entry fee I ask you. And right now it's on sale for like, I think, $13.50 or something like that over at Amazon. And thank you so much for the kind emails that you sent me. I got some amazing emails. If you want to see those, they're on the site, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Everything we talk about today is on the site, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, in the show notes. And we're going to start off in a moment with an interview and a discussion with a good friend of mine, an old friend of mine, Jordan Goodman. So let's kick it off right now with a conversation with a good friend of mine, Jordan Goodman, who is an author, and he also is known as America's Answer Man. And actually, Jordan, what is the actual title that you go by?
People call me America's Money Answers Man, and my website is moneyanswers.com.
And the reason for that is, and I am a testament because I just finished his book, is because he is, and he has every answer. I met Jordan, back in, 1994, Jordan?
Something like that. That's right. I was at Money Magazine for many, many years, and we got together then. I've been answering questions ever since, as of you.
I tell you something. We had a great time then. I was really impressed with the work he did. He had a book that was just gigantic about answers to all sorts of money questions. I think it was called the Everything Money Book, wasn't that?
Everyone's Money Book.
Everyone's.
Correct.
It was every answer. I got to tell you, it was great.
It was only 970 pages, man.
It was unbelievable.
No, blow it up to be bigger than it was. It was not the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Right, I understand. But now he has a book called Fast Profits in Hard Times: 10 Secret Strategies to Make You Rich in Any Up or Down Economy, which is kind of neat because, you know, some of the things that I got from this book, Jordan, were really nice because most people don't write about them. You know, my book, for example, touches on, you know, basic core fundamentals of how to look at a stock or mutual fund or some even GICs. But you touched upon areas that are really kind of not the norm and how you can make money.
Right.
I loved it. I just loved it.
That's why I call them secret strategies, because typically these are things you're not going to hear about from your financial planner, broker, lawyer, CPA.
So why is that?
They're not going to tell you about tax liens or oil royalty trusts or
I don't necessarily think that they
don't make any money from them.
Well, they don't make money, but I don't think it's necessarily because they don't want to. I don't think they know about them either, because you pick an area of study, I think, and then, you know, you kind of go with that. But so tell me about the idea of tax liens, and is it a good time to do
sure.
it now, or tell me how it works.
Great time to do it now. With a tax lien, what happens is when a taxpayer, local property taxpayer, does not pay their property taxes on time, the municipality places a lien on that property, and when they pay their property taxes late, there's a penalty interest rate, which varies by state. It's as low as 8%, as high as 25%, for example, in Texas. So when the property owner pays their property taxes late, you who have owned the lien get that penalty interest rate plus your money back. So the worst you can do is 8 to 25%, basically guaranteed by the municipality. The best you can do is if the property owner does not pay their property taxes at all, and you get to buy the property, which could be worth several hundreds of thousands of dollars for the amount of the property taxes, which could be, you know, $3,000, $4,000, whatever it may be. Now, you're not going to expect that to happen every time, but in many cases it can happen. And particularly today, I mean, the strategies I talk about in Fast Profits and Hard Times are designed to benefit from what's going on in the economy today, and a lot of people aren't able to pay their property taxes. Therefore, liens are being placed on their property in record numbers, and therefore there's lots available, and there's lots of ways of picking up some mm-hmm. very valuable properties for incredibly low prices.
So now a municipality would do this because they don't want to, you know, they're basically shifting the payment process over to an investor, right? I mean, because
they want to get their property taxes. They have to pay their police and their teachers and firemen and so on. And so there's an auction of these liens once they're placed, typically once a month at most municipalities. And you can either go there in person. Actually, today, a lot of them are online. And you have to register with that municipality and say, I'm going to be a registered, you know, investor or bidder at these auctions, mm-hmm. and then you bid away. And in many cases, you'll be the only one there, Andrew.
Really?
Know about this. There are far, far more liens than right. there are investors in the liens.
Well, I'm in Florida, so I'm sure there's chock full of...
Florida has tons of those liens. Capital of tax liens. Yeah.
Right. So here, you know, actually I heard that Vegas was also a big one. Obviously, any place that has a high level of...
Foreclosures and real estate stress mm-hmm. means you have a lot of tax liens. So... and some states are lien states, some are tax deed states, and I kind of explain the difference between the two.
Right.
You just have to really understand how to play the game, but if you do it right, you can do fantastic. Now, some of the things you should not do are do not buy gas stations or former gas stations or houses near gas stations, because you don't want to have dig up a tank that's got EPA problems all over
right.
it, toxic waste
right.
sludge or something like that.
Right.
So just buy a nice single-family home. Nothing fancy that you'll be able to buy. I'll tell you a story. Throughout each of the chapters of the book, I give specific examples of real-life people who've done these different strategies.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, there's a person I knew in Oklahoma who bought a tax lien for, I think it was $3,000 on a home worth $300,000. I think it was in Tulsa area, something like that. And now, in many cases, there's a mortgage on the house. So, typically, the bank will take you out because they don't want to lose everything they've got, you know, in the property. So in this case, there was a small local Oklahoma bank that had the mortgage on the property that was in the process of being taken over by Wachovia, a big bank. So it was after the homeowner says they're not going to pay their taxes, the bank gets 60 days, so-called redemption period, to be able to pay it off. So the little bank said to the big bank, you take care of it because you're taking this over. The big bank said to the little bank, you take care of it because you were alone originally. Neither of them did. The 60 days passed. And the guy bought a home worth $300,000 for $3,000.
I mean, obviously, that's not the absolute norm, but But it does happen, and at the end of the day, if you don't get that, you still made your 8 to 25%. And that, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I'm thumbing through page 42 right now, and we're talking about Jared Brown, and Jared Brown had a tax lien, and he invested about $8,000. Actually, this is another one in Pennsylvania that got about $287,000 back. And Sarah Cook on page 43. So what's nice about this, if I may give you a major plug here, is that not only is there, you know, the how to do it, but then you give the how to example so people can put themselves in that position, if that's what I'm assuming.
And they can say, are all real people. These
right.
are all real people.
Wow, that's
that have
great.
Happened,
that's great. Yeah, there's so many books out there.
Again, you're not going to hear about from your accountant or financial planner. Probably.
Yeah, I hear you. You know, and there's so many books out there that are I think, good information, but not actionable.
Right.
You know, you have kind of like a great set of and a great set of information, and then you're like, okay, now what? Right?
Yeah.
You know?
So at the end of each chapter, I give specific 800 numbers, websites, resources, trade associations, mm-hmm. books, and other resources to help you put this into action. So at the end of the tax lien chapter, I've got all kinds of resources that allow you to put that into action. There are lists of all the different counties and how you register for them. You know, it's a little bit of a business you have to get into, but the payoffs can be enormous. The only thing about this, Andrew, with tax liens, is you don't know when you're going to get paid.
Mm-hmm.
It depends when the homeowner pays their property taxes late. Could be the next week, could be a year from now, so you don't know exactly when you're going to get paid. But you are going to get paid one way or the other, and then potentially, if you don't get paid, it's the best of all worlds. You get to buy the property at a song.
Right. So here's another one. You talk about master. You know, actually, let me just back up for a second, because this is what I think is really great about this, because it's not that. Listen, tax liens is just one chapter. You have things on building wealth with below market value real estate, which probably is something that can be used right now.
Absolutely.
Significantly.
You know, great fortunes are being made as we speak right now, and
right.
particularly in real estate, because the difference in real estate right now in Florida, but a lot of other places, is when 2 and 3 years ago, you could not get positive cash flow real estate. The prices were so high.
Right.
And the speculators were just bidding things up to ridiculous levels. There's no way the rents you could get would kind of cover your costs, and your property taxes, and your mortgage, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now the prices have come down to such levels. And rents have gone up because people can't afford to buy. They have to rent. They have to live somewhere. That it does make a lot of sense. You can get positive cash flow real estate because you get, you know, higher rents and lower costs. So this is the best of all times if you have cash or credit to be able
right.
to buy really good quality real estate.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously the same thing goes here. You're giving examples, and I just really need. You know what I really liked also was two things. Number one, you have a chapter on options, which is great because it talks about how to hedge your bets and how to hedge your portfolio against disasters
right.
and all that, which is really great. But
well,
I thought
the market's going down. Most people think there's no way you can make money from it, but with options, you can buy what's called a put, which gives you the right to sell the underlying stock or stock index at a particular price by a particular date. If it goes down, you profit mightily. Now, I've been doing puts, for example, on both individual financial stocks and financial indices.
Mm-hmm.
I bought a put, for example, on Countrywide last fall when it was about $20 a share.
So oh, you're so smart! You're so smart, aren't you?
And that went from 20 to 4
yeah, no
before
kidding.
Bank of America took it over at 7 or something.
Oh. That's
so the
beautiful.
Value of the put went up as the stock went down dramatically. And there's a lot of leverage involved. So the stock went from 20 to 4. The put went from 1 to 15.
Right.
Okay.
I know, I hear
so
you.
So if you do it right, you can make yourself a lot of money in the down market with puts and calls the other
right.
way as well.
Well, that's because you get the leveraging. And just since we're bragging about stories here, you know, I had a and actually on the show, I talked about how this particular stock called VMware, which it was one of those moments of clarity where I said, that stock is going down because of this. It was, you know, very clear to me. I knew about
yeah.
the Microsoft situation. I knew what was happening. Microsoft was basically going to cut them off at the knees and provide.
It was a very hot momentum stock
yeah.
for a while there, yeah.
102, I was saying to everybody, get out, get out, get out. We put a put on it, and earnings came out. It was down $50. It was gorgeous. Dollar, a dollar put turned out to be a $13.50 put when I sold it.
Beautiful. Almost instantly, yeah.
Yeah, great. So, you know, the
That's the way you can really hedge on the downside. So, yeah, again, in hard times, people, the average person out there, Andrew, would say, there's no way to make money. Just put your head under a pillow and hope it all goes away and it'll get back to normal. But that doesn't work in this kind of environment.
Right, they're paralyzed, right? I mean, that's what's happening right now, what I find, is people are, I was at a party this weekend talking to some very good friends of mine, and we're talking about, you know, how you're making money. I said, what do you mean how you're making money? There's really only one way to make money right now. It's to bet against the markets. I mean, essentially, at that point, I was talking to them. Well, how do you do that? Well, you could short stocks. You could buy puts. You could do this. You could do What do you mean? Well, I said you could have inverse ETFs. What do you mean? Why would you?
It's all new to most people.
Yeah. Not only is it new, though. You know, let's explore this for a second. I think most people think it's bad. You shouldn't make money if stocks go down. You know,
it's not immoral. It's completely legal, and it's part of the markets. The markets need people on both sides of the trade.
Right. It's kind of like it's like the crap table.
One way market. You know.
Yeah, the crap table when you play the don't come line, right? Everybody looks at you like you're bad. You know, what do you mean? You're betting against me?
I think making money is good.
Yes.
A lot of other people are losing it.
Right.
You know, you're going to be in a much better position to help society if you're making money. But look at what's happening to all the people who are getting foreclosed on their homes, who are having, you know, huge debt problems, whose retirement savings aren't close to, you know, financing their needs. They're a burden on society. The people who are doing well are, you know, the golden goose that everybody else live off of.
Right. We're talking with Jordan Goodman, who is the author of a great book called Fast Profits in Hard Times, 10 Secret Strategies to Make You Rich in an Up or Down Economy. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Looking for answers to today's complex financial markets? Then be sure to get your copy of The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, your all-in-one guide to investing. Order now at thedisciplinedinvestor.com or your favorite bookstore. The Disciplined Investor. Together, we will reach success.
Hi, this is Grammar Girl from quickanddirtytips.com, and you're listening to The Disciplined Investor Podcast.
All right, we're back with Jordan Goodman. And, you know, Jordan, you have a chapter that's called Profiting by Doing Nothing. Chapter 10, Passive Income Strategies.
Right, my favorite chapter.
I love that. That's kind of like the couch potato profit center, huh?
It is. Well, the idea is if you set something up that works, either you don't have to do anything or you have to do something minimal or maybe have other people, you know, keep it going for you. And it can continually produce cash with little or no effort on your part. So that's what people like. That's what I call passive income strategy. So, for example, one of my favorites is what are called POS, point of sale, or credit card swiping machines. Now, every time you go to a convenience store or a movie theater or a taxi cab or an airport or wherever it may be, your credit or debit card is being swiped. Every time that happens, the merchant is paying a fee to the owner of that machine, typically about 50 cents or so, for the privilege of getting the money deposited in their account right away. What you do is there are companies that assemble portfolios of credit card swiping machines. Mm. So you are receiving those fees instead of paying them, in effect. Mm. And the yields on these things are really quite high, 20 to 25% typically. They place the machines in high-volume locations, you know, Walmart, shopping centers, airports, taxi cabs, you know, where there's just you just want a lot of swiping going on.
Right.
And whenever that happens, you're getting these fees. They then bring the money together for you. They pay you a check, typically a monthly check. It comes out to an annual yield of about 20 to 25%.
Wow.
And you are sleeping. Everybody else is swiping, and you're making money.
Swiping and sleeping. I love that.
Made a thousand swipes, boom out there.
Yeah, so what we got
distorting Mao a little bit.
You know? Yeah, I hear you. What we got from the last one is making money good, losing money bad, right? That's what we got a moment ago.
Right.
And now we got swiping while we sleep, and that's great, making profits. You know, Jordan, if you want to check out his stuff, we're going to have all of the information on the show notes from the show, but also moneyanswers.com is the place to find a lot of writing and insight and great information from Jordan, as well as the information on this book, Fast Profits in Hard Times. Let's skip over. I have a different question for you. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, the general problems right now with the get rich quick. Because I don't think that's really what you're professing here. But haven't we been living in this kind of get rich quick environment where everybody wants to get it now?
Well, particularly, I mean, the last few years, real estate is where people thought they could get rich quick. You know, because lending standards were so loose, they could put little or nothing down. Stated income loan, which people called wire loans, you know, put out whatever you want, nobody would check it. You know, if you could fog a mirror, you could get a loan.
Right.
And that cost for an awful lot of speculation, people trying to flip things very quickly. And it was like a game of musical chairs. And about the beginning of 2006, the music stopped. And a lot of people got stuck with it. So that was certainly a get-rich-quick kind of thing. Also, whenever you see any kind of trend, Andrew, you're going to see the scammers coming out and trying to cash in on Chinese stocks, gold, diamonds, oil, whatever it may be, whatever's hot, they're going to try to, you know, have you sweep along with that strategy.
Yeah.
Penny stocks, I mean, whatever it may be. if it looks too good to be true, if it's that instant fast profits, you have to ask, why aren't they doing it instead of telling me about it?
Yeah, why are they teaching about it? Well, let me tell you two things. First of all, the musical chairs didn't exactly stop. Yesterday, I got a business loan notice. Attention, Capital One business customer, which I'm not, by the way. I can get a $100,000 loan with, let's see, what does it tell me? 8%, 7-year payment, no application fee, no collateral, no financial statements required. It can be done in as little as 15 minutes up to $100,000.
What happened to the credit crunch?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, obviously, I have just as a side note, you know, obviously, I also do a lot of work in the area of stocks, but I have a huge short on Capital One Financial right now, and I don't want to get into all of that, but I have a huge problem with them in terms of the business practice as well as what they're doing. But
yeah, they've lent out money to people they know aren't going to pay them back, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And then the government comes in and just wipes it all clean, right?
Right, exactly.
what a great business. You know, talking about
that's been the get-rich-quick thing. Is you know, the latest hot thing, you know, certainly was real estate. Now it's the other side. Now it's people playing foreclosures, you know.
Right.
Whatever's hot now is where the scammers will go to try to sell something.
Let me tell you a quick story, and I'd like to relay this to people and ask you what you think. My father-in-law calls me up a couple days ago about a stock. He says, I think I want to buy the stock. I've been watching it since it's about 2. It's about 4 now. I said, really? First, I'm thinking, how did he know about this stock to begin with, right? So he tells me the stock symbol HYBD or something like that, Hybrid Technologies, and sure enough, that has happened. It's gone from 2 to about 4. Now it's moving towards 5. He wants to buy some of it. I said, well, what do you know? He's, well, I found out this information about this lithium battery they have and blah, blah, blah. I said, how do you find out? I got a fax. I said, you got a fax?
Yeah.
How do you get a fax? What do you mean a fax? I don't know. I got a fax. I get these faxes all the time. It looks really good to me. I said, So I did a little research on it, and I found a website that is actually the company that is doing the promotion of this stock, who was recently paid $25,000 to do the promotion of the stock. And what's fascinating is they show the date that they started doing the promotion is the exact date the stock started moving up.
This is what's called a pump and dump scheme.
Mm-hmm.
Because what they do is they pump up the stock with faxes, with emails, with regular mailings and slick kind of brochures. You know, so there is a lot of enthusiasm generated. These stocks do move up temporarily, and then the people who own the shares inside dump into that public enthusiasm, brief public enthusiasm, and then after the promotion's over, the thing dumps back to where it was.
Right. Just kidding. They keep on doing it.
But now it's so much easier to do these things because of the internet and faxes. And, you know, you can get massive amounts of promotion out there very quickly and very cheaply today.
Well, how come that's legal? I mean, I don't really understand how that's allowed to happen.
Well, they do have disclosures in there. I get these all the time, particularly mail kinds of things. And they do disclose, you know, that they paid $150,000 for this promotion or whatever it may be, and they do disclose it. So after they've disclosed it, you know, it's caveat emptor, basically.
Wow. Yeah, well, just I guess that's the point of all of this, right? Caveat emptor is to make sure you know what you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, the strategies that I talk about in Fast Profits and Hard Times are the real thing. And these are things I've all checked out. I've know real people who do them for real. And, you know, you can do very well in this environment if you go the opposite direction. I'll just give you an example. The dollar has been falling very sharply against foreign currencies, you know, for quite a while, and I think will continue to because of the deficits we have, both trade and budget. When the Fed keeps lowering interest rates and Europe is pretty much holding theirs the same, that makes our currency go down compared to others. There's a whole reason why the dollar is going down. So there are conservative and aggressive ways to play that. The conservative way is to buy CDs denominated in foreign currencies.
Mm-hmm.
So as the U.S. dollar falls, your money's now in euros, in yen, in Canadian dollars, in British pounds, whatever it may be. And in fact, you earn the interest rates in those countries and have an FDIC-insured way to benefit as the U.S. dollar falls. That's the conservative way to play it. The more aggressive way is to actually do foreign exchange trading.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a whole chapter on that where it's what are called currency pairs. You buy one currency and you sell another. So you buy the Canadian dollar, you sell the U.S. dollar, whatever it may be. One of them is always going up, one of them is always going down.
Right.
And if you get that right, and there's all kinds of software that kind of shows trends and so on, you can make yourself a lot of money because it's very leveraged, 100 to 1, sometimes as much as 400 to 1 leverage on something like that. So those are two ways to benefit from the fall of the U.S. dollar. Instead of just keeping your money in U.S. dollars and watch it become confetti, which is what's happening now. I mean, they are pouring money out like crazy. In every way possible. Oh, the Fed just, you know, pumped another $300 billion into the economy today, and they just bailed out Bear Stearns for $30 billion, and they, you know, it's just, they're creating money much faster than you could ever print it. I mean, the good old days in Weimar Germany, they actually had to print and use trees. Today, you don't even have to do that. You know, they just electronically create all this cash. Well, that's making the dollar go down.
Well, the good news is it's backed by gold, isn't it?
Not since about 1971. So that hasn't worked too well. Had they continued to have it backed by gold, you couldn't do what we're doing right now. We're inflating our way out of this thing, and the markets are not stupid. So they see that. And they know the value of the dollar is going down as more and more of them being created all the time.
Well, again,
you could just sit there as a U.S. citizen, and I hear this all the time, Andrew. Well, my money is safe. I've got it in a savings account or CD earning 2%. You know, my money is completely safe. I say, well, that's nice, but what is the purchasing power of that money doing? What's happened to your gas costs recently? What's happened to your food costs? Oh, those are going way up. So, in fact, it's the least risky, it's the most risky strategy, what you think is the least risky. By keeping your money in a so-called safe account at the bank.
Yeah. I have a little bit of a different take on the U.S. dollar, but still, the point well taken that there is ways to make money on the currency exchange rates, and the fact of the matter is that you could do it either, like you said, either an aggressive way or a conservative way. The fact of the matter is if you want to buy some of these mutual funds that are, under your scenario, buy some of these mutual funds that are fully denominated in euros, let's say, that invest in the international markets, I believe there's a little bit of right now, as we sit here right now, there's a little bit too much of an inflated amount of the currency value inside of those. So you're, if it does turn, and mind you, you know, Paulson and all these guys talk about a strong dollar policy, which is
the biggest joke I've ever seen.
The biggest joke. It's unbelievable. But nonetheless, you know, the fact is that a strong dollar is good for America. Truth also is that.
But we don't have one.
We haven't had one for a long time. Right, exactly. That's the fact. I mean,
I agree. It would be nice to have a strong dollar policy, but there's nothing we're doing that's going to make that happen, as far as I can see. Our budget deficit is not going to go down. In fact, it's going up with what we're doing right now. Our trade deficit may come down a little bit, but you know, if we're importing a lot of $100 a barrel oil, that's not going to help our trade deficit that much. Interest rates are going to continue to fall.
Yeah.
So all these reasons, I think, you know, maybe there's an occasional bump back up in the dollar, but the long-term trend, I think, has continued to be down.
Yeah, it's a problem. I you know, I could get into this for hours, this whole discussion of what that really means to us, I mean, as a country. And the truth of the matter is that it's really what the world is seeing the value of our country as, is the value of the dollar. And that does not bode well for what they think of.
Well, there's places like Iran and Venezuela. They may have a political agenda, but they're not taking dollars for oil anymore. And even Bahrain and some other places are talking about a basket of currencies instead of taking dollars for oil. I mean, in the long run, if the dollar was not the world's reserve currency, then you'd really see a flight from the dollar.
Well, what
happened? Not there yet, but that's the direction things are going.
You know, it's interesting because do you remember when on the book jackets it would say one price U.S., one price Canada?
Right. Now it's reversed.
Now it's reversed. It's unbelievable. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing in a way. You know,
the Canadian dollar, not that long ago, was like 60 cents, and now it's like $1.10 or something like that.
Unbelievable. I think that, by the way, I do have an absolute way out of all of this. I have the way to solve all of our economic problems.
Sounds good to me. Tell me.
Merge with Canada.
Ah. Well, I don't think they would want us.
That's the problem. That's the problem. We'd have our health insurance taken care of. They'll have their, you know, we don't have to cross borders for prescription drugs anymore. The dollar will be stronger. You know, we no longer have to, you know, worry about a single.
I'll tell you, though, there's two Canadas. I know a lot about Canada. I've actually been up there a lot recently. And there are two Canadas. Eastern Canada is very depressed right now because the strong Canadian dollar is making their exports very uncompetitive. You know, they have a lot of auto plants and that kind of thing. Western Canada is booming, particularly Alberta and Saskatchewan, where they have oil at $100 a barrel. They're doing really well. And Vancouver and all that, you know, British Columbia is doing well. They've got the Olympics coming there and so on.
Right.
But if we had to do that, I'd only want to merge with Western Canada.
Okay,
I'm
there.
Okay with you.
That's good. That's good.
What I call Cascadia.
I'm with you. I'm ready to go. Now, let me ask you one more question. Let's get back to your book for a second, Fast Profit in Hard Times. What was the inspiration? I know we're going a little bit backwards here, but really, what was the inspiration? Because you've written so many books. You've written so many articles. I mean, really, well-respected.
Well, the inspiration, in late 2006, when I came up with the idea, I said, well, when this book comes out in 2008, what's the world going to be like, and what is going to be of interest to people? And I said, I know things are going great right now, but I think all the chickens are going to come home to roost here. And the subprime mortgage is going to blow up, and all the derivatives and all the leverage in the system and this big bubble, this big boom we've had is just not going to last. So how can people do well in that kind of environment? And I said, there are some things people can do that they're not particularly going to hear about anywhere else that are really legitimate strategies. So I said, let me put together something that's going to help. And the book came out in January. And it immediately shot to number one on Amazon in the business book category, and has done very well since because people are looking at these kind of solutions and they're not finding them from their 401k, from their financial advisor, from anybody else particularly. We've talked about the dollar. We've talked about real estate strategies. We've talked about passive income. Just to give you another one, I mean, oil prices remain over $100 a barrel, and I think they're going to continue to go up just because of the basic supply-demand imbalance in the world. There's not much new supply being created or found, and there's lots of new demand being created all the time, particularly in Asia and China and India and so on. Everybody who converts from a bicycle to a car is creating more long-term demand for oil over there. So the basic supply-demand situation, you have on top of that the political uncertainty of Venezuela and Nigeria and Iraq, and they're blowing up pipelines and Iran and all these places. That's where the oil happens to be, so that makes oil traders nervous as it is. And then on top of that, you got the dollar. As the U.S. dollar falls, people want to put money in hard currency, and I would consider oil a form of hard currency. So oil rises as the U.S. dollar falls. So on top of the basic supply-demand situation, you have increased demand for oil as a form of hard currency to get your money out of U.S. dollars, in effect.
Again, I have something to say about that. It may not be the same scenario as... don't worry about that. You know why? We're all going to starve to death well before that.
Oh, good. Well, I'm a big believer of agriculturalists as well.
Right. I mean, you've seen what's going on. I mean, with the corn prices, wheat, I mean, with pizza inflation that we have going
all
on.
All of them, Now, there are ways to play that without having to do it in the futures market. There are exchange-traded funds that do a broad-based agricultural basket, for example. One of my favorite is Moo, M-O-O. It's got all, it's an ETF of all the different agricultural sectors. There's something called DBA, which is Deutsche Bank Agriculture.
Yeah, that was done very well lately.
Very well. Kind of a quarter sugar, soybeans, corn, and wheat, I think, something like that. So there are ways of playing agricultural. You could play the potash companies, like Potash and Agrium.
And Monsanto and Mosaic.
Those kind of things. I mean, there are ways to play all these things. So I think we agree, Andrew, that this is a time when if you're in the right sectors, you can do extremely well. Most people are in the wrong sectors or even more dangerous in passive sectors, just in some S&P 500 index fund that's not going to get them very far. In fact, could hurt them. Or they're in CDs or money market funds where they think they're safe, and in fact, their money's deteriorating in front of their eyes and they don't even see it.
Yep. Well, you can listen to Jordan Goodman. You can go to moneyanswers.com or listen to him on the Voice America Business Channel where he has a show Mondays at 12 p.m. Eastern Time.
Actually, 12 p.m. Western Time. 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 p.m. Western Time. That's correct.
Western Canada Time?
Well, just Western Time, like Pacific Time. It's the same as Western Canada.
I hear you. Great stuff. And I'll have all the information about how to pick up his book and how to get to his site. And I would encourage you to pick up a copy of this book. Really great stuff. Really good information. I think much far outside the norm of your average, investments for Google heads, we'll say. And it's really going to give you some alternative advice that can make you some money, which is what we're all looking for and all looking to do. Thank you so much for joining me, Jordan. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Andrew. Really appreciate it.
Thanks. The Zach Zone is sponsored by Newsflasher.com, a new way to view headline news from all the major news sources. Get a wide-angle view of all the hot topics making news by viewing just a single page. Newsflasher. It's as quick as a flash. Type the word newsflash, then the letter R, .com, and see for yourself. The Zach Zone with Zachary Scheidt. Zach is a portfolio manager at Stearman Capital and blogs at ZachStocks.com.
Andrew, thank you. This was actually a slow week in terms of pricing, although we saw a lot of new IPOs filed over the last couple weeks. It's taken some time to get the roadshows up and running and management in front of investors, and so it'll probably be another week or two before we actually see these come to market. However, this week we had two secondaries price. The first one was KKR Financial. This is one of those financial stocks that's been depressed, and they were trying to raise some kind of emergency capital at the last minute. And they got the deal done, which is good news for the company, but at the same time, it wasn't great news for investors, and the stock continued to trade down a little bit from the pricing. These are tough. It's a tough time for financials and tough time to get investors excited about committing capital in this area. The second one, however, is a much different story. This was Alpha Natural Resources, or ANR. It's an energy company, and as you guys know, the energy companies have been getting all the press these days. The stock did awesome. It's up another $3.11 on Friday, which would be 7% or so. That's on top of Thursday, and Tuesday and Wednesday, all trading well from the offering. So this was a very successful deal, and expect to see more of those come over the next couple weeks. 2 weeks ago when we talked, you and I mentioned Blackstone, and I would like to point out Blackstone's actually up more than $4 from where we talked about it 2 weeks ago for more than a 25% gain. So I think there's still room for Blackstone to run. Basically, as these IPOs come out, they're going to be able to capitalize on the liquidity, and investors are going to see them post profits. And I think there's a good ways to go before you have to start worrying about Blackstone. The last couple weeks, I've had my the gas pedal down hard. And we've been making some serious money as the market's traded up. The new issues have been trading very, very well. However, right now I'm starting to ease off the gas a little bit. I'm not ready to hit the brakes, but we've had a good run, and it's likely that we'll see some consolidation. But one name, when we get the consolidation, one name that you should be looking at as far as a purchase is eHouse China, ticker symbol EJ, Edward John. This is actually a real estate broker in China. Similar to what you'd see in REMAX or Century 21 here in the States. These guys have made their primary business be the moneymaker for them, where they basically have agreements with the developers of new properties in China. And so what happens is these new neighborhoods are built, or these new buildings, residential buildings are built, and eHouse gets the exclusive rights to sell all of the units, and they can make a killing. One of the things that's had the stock get pushed back down is that the Chinese regulators have tried to slow down the housing inflation, and they basically put some regulations as far as who can get mortgages and so forth, and this has had the effect of letting prices not decline but not grow quite as rapidly. However, that's not a real big concern for eHouse. The reason why is because this actually underscores the need for the agents to be able to help the developers sell their land or their properties. And so there's even more of a need for the services that eHouse offers. So I think that the sell-off in the stock actually gives you a great opportunity to buy. And actually, over the last couple weeks, eHouse has moved back up above its IPO offering range, which is a great sign, technically speaking. And it should be in a great place fundamentally to make some money. The valuation is very good in the sense that the stock is supposed to earn 87 cents per share this year and $1.18 next year, and the stock's actually trading just over $15 a share. So that gives you a chance to buy a great growth company at a lower multiple. And there's one thing that you should think about when looking at this. It's not just an agency. They have also developed this new database product, which is the equivalent of the US FMLS system. Now, they haven't gotten much revenue out of the system yet, but it's pretty exciting to think that if you created the FMLS system 20 or 30 years ago, how much money you'd be making off of all the listings now in the U.S. Well, this may be the exact same thing in China. So keep an eye on the eHouse. I think it could be a great opportunity long-term, and could give you a short-term opportunity to trade something from the long side here. For more information on this and other stocks that have recently come to market, come give me a visit at zachstocks.com. That's Z-A-C-H stocks.com. And Andrew, I look forward to talking to you next week. Thanks.
Hey, Zach, thanks so much. Great stuff out there. We're going to put the links to the symbols on the show notes for today, and we're going to be looking forward to some more great stuff from Zach. Zach at zachstocks.com. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
In 3, 2, 1. And now back to the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
All right, we are here with a very special guest today. We are here with John Byrne, who is the executive editor of Business Week. He's been there since, John, has it been since 2005? Is that how long you've been there?
Yeah, although, Andrew, I'm an old hand here. What happened is I was a writer for 17 and a half years at Business Week. During that time, I wrote 57 cover stories, wow, among other things.
Wow.
And 8 books. Then I left to become editor-in-chief of Fast Company magazine. I was at Fast Company for 2.5 years. Then it was sold, and I left after it was sold and came back to Business Week, not as a writer, but as executive editor of the magazine. I had that job for 2 years, and then I went online. And I've been utterly transformed like you.
Yeah, no, it's amazing because, listen, back, I think it was 1994. As a matter of fact, another guest that we just had on this show, we have two guests this show, that we just spoke to is Jordan Goodman. And the last time I spoke to Jordan was 1994, when I had a radio show back then called The Money Doctor Show. It was kind of a fun thing that I did down in Miami. And we hooked up again kind of on the next, you know, the next revolution of media. You know, he's doing a lot of online stuff, and, you know, he's doing this whole... His radio is all online as well. But it's amazing how this new media, which I want to talk to you about, but I want to talk about some business too, but this new media is quite amazing because it's so directed. People love it. They could do it when they listen to it when they want to. And the opportunity for people to find others is really, you know, it's quite amazing.
Yeah, plus, you know, I've come to believe that it's not another medium anymore. Mm-hmm. I really believe it's like a utility, like electricity, because... You know, the online world is TV, radio, print, all those combined and so much more in ways that we've never experienced before and in ways that we never will have experienced, meaning tomorrow and the next day after that.
Right.
Because this world is changing and evolving in incredible ways. Online, for example, you know, Business Week now has an audience that's twice the size of the audience we have in print. Our journalism has never reached or touched more people in its history, and we're doing that in, you know, incredible ways. We just won an award for narrated slideshows. We're doing some terrific video. We're doing some great basic journalism, but also, you know, what online does for a magazine journalist is something really unique, is this. You know, for years working in magazine journalism, you spent ungodly amounts of time learning the subject, investing in it, and then writing intelligently about it. Mm-hmm. And then you walked away from your subject because you were a magazine.
Right.
Online, in many ways, there's something old-fashioned about it. You can just plug away one story after another on a particular topic because the medium allows it, and there's no more fun in journalism than doing that. Well, because you've already made the investment, you've got your sources, and now you can move the story incrementally, and in magazines you can't do that.
Well, also, to kind of put it in a dimensional state, I guess the magazine, in a way, was one-dimensional. You know, you put it out, it's on a newsstand, it's, you know, delivered, it's somewhere, it's in a doctor's office somewhere, something, and somebody flips through it and gets it, and then kind of that's it. First of all, you read it, you absorb it. There's no way to get back to. I mean, how did you ever, ever, ever get back to a writer back then? And now you have the opportunity, just from a online standpoint, to have much more of a dimension, because I know that many stories, whether it's Business Week or other, you know, periodicals online, I've written a comment and the writer writes back to me, and we have this dialogue. This in the Web 2.0 world, it's called the conversation, but I hate that word. I just hate it. I think it's right. Much more of an interaction.
I agree.
You know, and this interaction, I think, not only is just a very blatant question and answer. Oh, I don't understand this. Why don't you explain it? It's more of, hey, you know, wow, as from your side, John, from the magazine side, maybe there's a source of information here that I was unable to tap previously because it was really invisible to me.
Yeah, we have a great reporter on Walmart who has won awards for her Walmart coverage online and for having had many scoops on Walmart. And frankly, most of her sources come off our online comments. Hmm. Readers who are inside the company, who anonymously post comments on the site about the company, but who we have emails for, and have proven to be incredible wealth of deep sourcing for that reporter.
Mm, that's great. Let's kind of do a switch over to the area of business for a minute, because I know that, you know, I look back to even just your with a quote around just your cover story, because you do the cover story podcast for Business Week as one of your thing, and you talk about an in-depth look with the writer of what's gone on with that, and you really, I'm going back to even to my birthday, March 20th, waking up to the recession, which was actually that was March 13th, I believe. You had the discussion about consumer vigilantes and, you know, talking way back. I even went back a number of months really talking about what's going on with this economy. So I'm going to ask you, why is it that it seems to me that with all the information that's out there and with all the concern, it looks like everybody's head is still somewhat in the sand when it comes to saying whether we're in a recession or not, and who really cares if it's an actual recession? We have huge problems economically, and why is everybody so stubborn to admit this?
You know, it's like recession is a dirty word. And until it's confirmed by the economist, and the economists define it in the most technical of ways, which is basically two quarters of declining growth.
Right.
And it takes forever to even find out if a quarter has declined, and there's always revisions and everything
revision,
else.
Right.
You know, so you basically won't know that there's a recession until the recession is over.
I
think that it's beyond dispute that where we are in a recession, and the data will prove it out. And to your point, even if we aren't overall, there are some sectors of the economy that are so important to the economy that clearly are in recession, whether it's the housing market, whether it's autos, that it's beside the point.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think we are suffering through a recession already. I think maybe the economists will declare one by the end of the year. Who knows? It may take them that long. But I think it's here, folks, and a lot of people are feeling it, and there's a lot of hurt out
right
there.
So where's the next shoe? I've been really – every once in a while I get on a little bit of a – listen, I'm a money manager, so I'm embroiled in this daily. I'm trying to find the good, the bad, the ugly every day, right, because we're going to figure out how our portfolios are going to be managed accordingly. And every once in a while I – for those of people that know me, I get a little bit like too involved in something. For example – last summer, I was a Crocs maniac. I was berserk on Crocs, and I was writing everything. I was a Crocs hater. You know, I would put up a post. I would get so many emails like I killed someone that close to anybody and hurt their family dearly, which, you know, and trying to tell them that, you know, Crocs may have some great things, you know, all the good things about it, but the fundamentals are only temporary, in my opinion. And then the determining factor, what really put me over the edge on Crocs, was when I got an email from someone that told me that the Crocs rubber, the shoe material itself, was so good, was such a wonderful antibacterial and such a great compound that they decided to make toilet seats out of it. I said, that's it. Short. We're shorting for sure now, and double your shorts, okay?
you know when that happens what it means. It means the fad is beginning to be over. And now there's talk that, oh my God, we have something that we can diversify with because we can't count on this fad continuing.
Right. No, I mean, let me give you my next compulsion, okay? It's the credit markets in terms of credit cards, unsecured debt. It seems that we know there's a housing problem. It seems that we know that there is this subprime, whatever you want to call it, mess or fiasco. We know that there is potential problems in that area. We know that the auto industry also is having huge problems, but yet it seems to me that this whole idea of credit card debt has not really been brought out to the level it should be. And let me ask you about that, and then I want to ask you about a specific company. You know, what do you think about that? Are we going to have a problem here?
I think we already have a problem. In some cases, people are totally swamped by their debt. There's no doubt that we borrowed way too much money. Historically, in fact, I think the number out there is something like in the last 5 years, we're roughly $3 trillion above what we would be given historical patterns. Hmm. We did a series online, in fact, on how debt is swamping people who don't even have jobs. And I'm talking credit card debt, because credit card companies have been so aggressive, particularly on college campuses, mm-hmm. offering credit to people who have no means to pay it back, and have basically swallowed up people in debt, and it's a major problem. And the other thing that's happening that we've written about extensively is how, you know, the reason, partly why the reason there was so much credit available is because there are mafia-style interest rates that mm-hmm. you can legitimately charge today.
Mm-hmm.
And for the smallest infraction, you know, being a day late on a payment or not making the minimum payment or even approaching your limit of credit mm-hmm. can allow a credit card company to increase interest rates to the point where, you know, it's sort of kneecapping rates.
Right, and you can't get out of it.
Yeah, and you can't get out of it. It's just sort of a...
Don't they call that the universal default too? They can throw that in there these days, where they could just kind of. And that's there's a law. That's the other thing that's concerning me. There's a law that is, or at least there is legislation that is going to be, you know, doing away with a lot of this, and the credit card companies who have been gathering a lot of money by, as you say, you know, pretty much being the legal loan shark. You know, in fact, it's going to have to be curtailed dramatically. I have in my hands, I just got this, no kidding, a business loan application from Capital One. I get up to $100,000. Let's see what it says. $100,000, no application fees, no collateral requirements, and no financial statements needed.
Wow.
I mean, I'm going to go get it. I mean, what the heck, right? I figured it says 15 minutes all it's going to take. Why not? I think I'm going to go check it out. But seriously.
Well, I'm going to tell you, the market is not betting this is going to be much regulation, because look how well the Visa IPO did.
But the Visa IPO, that's the just as a point of reference, I go back and forth with the Visa IPO. The Visa IPO is more of a, you know, they're a transaction company. But the same problem is if they're not going to be allowing this much credit problems, Visa should have difficulty. And by the way, here's my piece on Visa IPO. The Visa IPO wouldn't have come out if we didn't have the bear situation. Now, at first, when I first wrote about it, it was picked up in Financial Times when I wrote about this, in New York Times, because I said the Visa IPO is the worst time this can come out at all. The worst time. Why would anybody come out with an IPO right now? But then I realized, when you looked further into it, there was $1.5 billion that was being paid to various banks, Bank of America, National City, and a few others that got the IPO proceeds, and it was one of those things that had to happen. They had to get this money to get, you know, because right now the big problem is time. Time is the enemy of all these banks and all these problem companies right now.
Right.
So if they can extend it and they can hope that things are going to pass over and people will get back their confidence, I think what's going to happen is that they're going to be, you know, feeling much better and maybe have greater liquidity. But Capital One, this is my new one. This is the thing I'm compulsing on. Capital One, when I did the numbers on Capital One, they're assuming a 6% write-off rate. And by the way, why is it that I could just say write-off without even flinching these days? Isn't write-off a bad thing?
Sure, it's a bad thing, but I think we've become immune to it. In the same way that we became immune to, you know, $20 and $30 million annual compensation for CEOs.
Mm-hmm. I just don't understand you. You say you're going to have a $5 billion write-off. Oh, that's good. They won't have the debt anymore. No, that's not exactly right. You know, but that's what really I think we're all thinking. You know, just wipe it off the books. But Capital One has a $50 billion. Last, I just looked at the annual report and I just ripped it apart. They have $50 billion of off-balance sheet securitized loans outstanding that they sold, where while they don't have the same liability, if you will, for that, my concern is that they probably, and I'm not confirmed on this because I can't know, they probably put the worst loans in that securitization package, or at least the batch of securitized packages, and sold them off for the better interest rates, because the guys that got it had to get a piece too. Everybody has to get a piece of this deal. And I'm concerned that the 6% number that they're talking about for a fall-off rate is much higher. And if you utilize that and their leverage and the amount of assets they have, and this is where my next concern, I'll just end it on this. What can they do to raise money to save themselves? Well, they can do a bond offering. They can do a stock offering. They're not going to do that because that wouldn't look good, right? So what they could do is they could raise their interest rates and bring in money. They've done that. They just did that. The second thing is they did a $3 billion recent buyback of shares and they raised their dividend. Those two things, the dividend doesn't cost them anything if they start doing the buyback. And in the background, the CEO is selling shares. For the last 8 weeks, I think the number, although there's a little confusion about what's in and out and what was planned, but it was like $21 million worth of share sales in the last 8 weeks.
So, Andrew, what makes me think that you're not recommending Cap One to your clients?
Yeah, I just don't understand it. I don't understand how this thing is still floating. I just don't understand. We're shorted. I'll be honest. I mean, full disclosure, we're short. That's not why I'm talking about it. I'm talking about it because I don't understand how we're just letting things like this just, you know, be okay. Lehman Brothers last week, right? They do an offering, $4 billion. Where do they get the money from?
Right.
They get the money from their buddies so that it looks like there's money being floating. But you know what? If you're a Siamese twin and something happens to you and your other twin is going to give you something to make sure you live or else you both die. Right?
I would hope so.
I would hope so. And that's what's happening here. And then the final.
And to your point, I'll just say this. You know, what makes it surprising is that we are at a time when the public and the market should be ever more suspicious than ever about a crappy balance sheet,
mm-hmm.
or things that just don't seem quite right. And yet, we're not as suspicious as we should be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what's really what underlines what you say.
Yeah, I mean, we just hope everything's going to be okay. That's the bottom line to all this. But anyway, we'll junk that. I'll just tell you, the only thing that bothered me worse than that was when Lehman announced last week that they're making big inroads and they're expanding into China. Why would we say that? Well, because everybody that goes to China makes a lot of money, right? So it looks really good. All right, so let's talk about, real quickly, your grade on the Paulson Bernanke plan bailout thing, whatever you want to call it now.
Well, look, you got to give the guy a lot of credit. I mean, he is redefining the role of Fed chairman,
mm-hmm.
and actually almost acting like the head of the Treasury Department, for Christ's sake.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And you know, the interesting thing about Bernanke is that when he went in, everyone presumed he was entering a diminished Fed, right? Because the economy had gotten so global that the ability of the Federal Reserve to control the American economy, which is so intertwined with everything else around the world, and after all, is financed by the Middle East and Asia, was much in question, right? Because mm-hmm. we assumed that he could never have as much influence on our financial system as Greenspan had, because it was sort of a new era. And it turns out that because of the crisis, the economic crisis we're in, caused by the subprime mess, Bernanke is sort of reinventing the role of what a Fed chairman can do and should do to try to prop up the economy or make it from certainly getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to give the guy credit for that, because there was no expectation whatsoever that he would be able to play the big role that he's playing. And I think he has risen to the challenge.
Yeah, it was trial
now,
by fire.
How it all plays out, you know, did he do this much too soon? Did he overreact here? I mean, that's all the sort of navel-gazing that occurs when you play such a visible and important role.
Mm-hmm.
I give the guy a lot of credit for doing things that we may not have expected.
Yeah, I hear you. No, and again, trial by fire with this guy. You know, I think that what was really the most fascinating part of that is that when he came in, we were all still goo-goo gaga over Greenspan.
True.
And it was like, oh, who's this schlub academic coming in? I mean, you know, from, again, comparatively, right? Because we're all...
Yeah, there's no doubt about it.
And now we're all saying, Greenspan, look what he did.
I mean,
it's,
I know.
Like 180. It's quite amazing the turn we have here.
Yeah, it really is.
So let me ask you about podcasting. So what was the big decision why Business Week decided to... I mean, you have, what, 20, 25 shows, I think?
Yeah, there are quite a few.
And huge downloads.
And we're doing more than a million downloads a month on the podcast, which is actually more downloads on podcasts in any given month than subscribers that we have to the magazine.
Wow.
And, you know, a lot of people kind of thought the whole podcasting thing peaked, and then the hot thing in online became video.
Yep.
But for us, the podcasts have remained strong. They continue to grow. And I think in part it's because what are you really doing with a podcast? To me, you're trying to create an intimate moment with an audience. I kind of like to think that what we're doing is we're at the end of a bar and we're having a fascinating conversation, so fascinating that other people in the bar kind of just want to, you know, tilt their ear toward mm-hmm. and listen to, almost as if they're voyeurs. And that's kind of what I want out of the podcast that I do. So that I also just think that, you know, it's an effective way to consume information. For a lot of business people who, you know, go to the gym or are commuting to work and want to just sort of fill their head with something that's important and substantive but somewhat entertaining, it's a way to do it.
Yeah.
And frankly, you know, who doesn't have an iPod? And if you're a professional and you want to get ahead in this world, you know, you're listening to not always music.
Yeah, I don't ever listen to music as awful as that sounds, because I never relax, it seems. But I'm always listening. I have an iPhone, and I'm chock full of podcasts that I'm always listening to. And I just, as a matter of fact, I just downloaded the entire, because I didn't even know it was, to be honest with you, I think I'm pretty up on this stuff, but I just downloaded the entire The Cutting Edge Business Week I think I have a year's worth of it that I downloaded just before we got on today. Really fascinating stuff about podcasting and all. But what is the, you know, there's been a lot of discussion and debate about the, and this is kind of a little different, the monetization of podcasts, because you know what, I'll tell you something, I think I pretty much stay tight to what's going on. And what I've noticed is my podcast was number, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 for a long time on iTunes, which is somewhat the benchmark of popularity.
Yeah, that's terrific.
And now it's, you know, number 20, it kind of moves around and it's number 8 or so on investing. But what I've noticed is I'm starting to think, why is it moving down? Is it because I'm losing subscribers? Well, no, that's not the case. I'm gaining subscribers. What's happening? I have noticed an absolute kind of a very recent, let's say 2008, change to who is actually podcasting. And who is it? The big boys. The big boys are coming in strong.
Yeah, and I think you're right. In the beginning, as is often the case, you get the real pioneers who are gonna do it, and they're gonna, and actually the pioneers are gonna establish the fact that this is a viable medium to exchange and to provide information, and then more big people come along and they use their clout through their brands to gain more traction. We were in on this pretty early, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess I did our first podcast 3 years ago.
Wow.
And so then we just sort of gathered and done more of them as time has moved on, and it's worked for us.
No, it's great. It's awesome.
And in terms of monetizing, you know, most of the podcasts are all profitable because we do have sponsors for them, and sponsors tend to like them, and they link them in with other programs. The Cover Podcast for a long time, for example, was a program that was featured with, you know, there were ads, contextual ads in the magazine for the story. There were contextual ads on the site that went along with not only the cover story, but with the commenting tool that allowed readers to engage in conversations or dialogue or mm-hmm. interactivity.
Right.
And then along with that was the podcast. So that one single advertiser was an online print with interaction with the readers in the magazine and on audio with the podcast.
Yeah.
So it kind of works for us well.
That's great. Well, I want to thank you for doing what you do in the area of not only podcasting. And by the way, I don't think that audio is dead by any means. I think there is my theory is that video, you need to have more than one sense doing it at a time. You can't do it when you're driving. You can't do it, you know, maybe if you're sleeping per se. I mean, I listen late at night and kind of sometimes have it in my ear. And, you know, you can't do it as well. And I don't think even though they like it because the ads are there, the bigger CPM, they call it, higher CPMs. The fact of the matter is I still think that audio, as radio hasn't gone out of play, I think that audio is very much here to stay. So thank you for all you do there, and keep up the great work with the Business Week. Obviously, we all know how great Business Week is. We're not going to have to plug that too much. Everybody knows how great it is. And I will put on the show notes, I will put a link to all the podcasts that are on available through Business Week on iTunes, as well as directly on the Business Week website. And I appreciate it, and hopefully we'll talk soon.
Great. And Andrew, good luck with your book.
Hey, thanks. I appreciate that. It's doing well. We'll get you some more information on that.
Terrific. Thanks.
All right. Thanks. And thanks again for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz. Pick up a book. Do me a favor. Call me if you need me. Write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Make sure to subscribe to the blog and do me a favor if you can. Post a review on iTunes and tell me what you think. Whatever you think, I appreciate, because we got to get that feedback and know exactly what you're looking for. If you have any show ideas, if you have any information you'd like to send on, whatever it is, askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And if you're looking to make money, who's not? Go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. That's where there's ideas throughout the week. I know you listen to this podcast and it's really easy. We kind of go through a lot of things, but there's so much more on there. And I want you to take a peek at that. Lots more coming. I'll tell you about what's going on with AOL, actually. And I'll tell you what's going on with a couple other groups that I'm going to be writing for very shortly. And you can get my information there as well. So this is, again, the end of the episode number 51. Thanks a lot for joining me. I'll see you real soon. See you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.